It is, what is today's date? The 12th.
December 5th. It's St. Telemachus.
Yes, December 5th. Okay, well, soon Pearl Harbor Day. If people still, the day is supposed to live in infamy, person is, how many of the young generation even knows that? I see Gershon is with us. So Gershon, you asked me last class about, is it Lashon with a comments under it, or Lashon Hara or Lishon Hara? And I repeated what I heard from Israel and a Medakdek, and I found it online also from Yeshiva Kisei Rachamim. I'll just tell you what it says here, and I don't pretend to understand it. The question was asked, do you say Bilashon Hara or Bilshon Hara? That's in, let's say, in the Machzor, we have it. And this is what they wrote. Kotvin Bechirik. That's Bilashon Hara. Not, hold on. No, the question is, well, why isn't it, why is it Bilashon Hara, not Bilashon Hara? And what he says is that it's not Smichut. That is, it's not Lashon Shehara, which would be Lashon Hara. Rather, it's Lashon Shehura. It's not Lashon of wickedness. Rather, it's Lashon, which is wicked. But I don't really understand that, because then it would be HaLashon Hara, not Lashon Hara. That's Smichut. It should be, I think, like Alkali says, Lishon Hara, but that's not how it's done. What can I say? But it's a good point. I don't know. And I was given the Haftorah. So it shows you how Ashkacha Pratis works. I was given the Haftorah on Shabbos, and lo and behold, Kli Thunda. If you paid attention to the Haftorah, you saw it, and I didn't even prepare ahead of time. I just was reading it, and lo and behold, there it was. I listened to the class last week, and I saw that I made a, I don't know how, I was looking right at it, and I said for some reason that Yehuda Nasiya is the grandfather of Yehuda Nasi. Well, that's obviously wrong. Yehuda Nasiya is the Amora, and his grandfather is Yehuda Nasi. So you can check that out. For those who've been with us many semesters, I just want to remind you of something, only because articles came out about it. You might recall in the classes on my latest book, we dealt with the responsum of Rav Ephraim Greenblatt, in which he made the really daring argument, which he said that Rav Moshe agreed with, that a woman who's converted as a baby can marry a kohen. That's a controversial position, I said, because it goes against the Shulchan Aruch, and Rabbi Greenblatt argued that you can rely on this rejected opinion, apparently rejected in the Gemara, well, at least the Rishonim rejected. Two articles have recently come out, one by, both of them actually, by Rabbi Michael Broyd and Rabbi Gideon Rothstein, both in Tachumen, which is a religious Zionist journal, and also in Or Yisrael, which is a Hasidic journal out of Borough Park. Well, it's actually published in Muncie, I should say. Both these articles, they're really the same article, different crowds, discussing Rabbi Greenblatt's position, defending it, showing how this is a read in various Rishonim, and showing even Achronim, who they think could be read in accord with this. So I can send any of people are interested in that. So I think that's interesting, because the book with Rabbi Greenblatt's tshuva is now becoming like a centerpiece for arguments, so much so that just last night I was with Rabbi, yesterday morning, at Shachris, Rabbi Yonah Reese, the Av Beis Din in Chicago, former head of Reitz. And he told me that he had read what Rabbi Broyd and Rothstein wrote, and he wasn't convinced at all. So I thought that was interesting. It's always nice to publish something which then others are speaking about. And finally, finally, I thank Ben Waxman. I guess you're in Israel, Ben. I don't know you, but thank you for writing to me, other than through emails, because I mentioned the Shabbos umbrella. And I quoted the rabbis who permitted it. I showed you the picture and I asked, does anyone know if there's been opposition to it? And also if the opposition is based on halacha or it's based on, it's not the Minhag Yisrael, these sort of arguments. And I know these arguments very well. Orthodoxy, much of orthodoxy is subject to those sort of arguments. So just to give you an example, I'm preparing now a talk for the Pesach program I go to. Those who live in New York area, you read the Jewish link, you probably saw my picture, because the first time the program now, I've been there like 7 years, but now they have my picture front and center. So let's hope it sells some spaces. But rather than just giving regular talks, which I do, I started a few years ago to speak about Pesach. So a couple of years ago, I spoke about Kitnios. In fact, the talk I gave on Kitnios, you can see it on the Torah in Motion website, on YouTube. I mentioned a new approach, a new explanation of where Kitnios comes from. Last year, I spoke about Gebrach. So this year, I'm speaking about Machine Matzah. Well, and the whole dispute about it. Now, if you look in the arguments about machine matzah, the people who opposed it after the first generation, they didn't know what the machine was, and they thought maybe it was chametz. But once everyone realized there's no chametz for machine matzah. In fact, for many Gedol Yisrael, it's better to use machine matzah. They dafka only want to use machine matzah. Then you have the arguments, especially from the Hasidic world, that goes against our Masorah. We don't make changes. So that was the sort of argument I asked about the Shabbos umbrella. And I thank you, Ben, because you sent me from Olam Katan, which is a newspaper in Israel. And let me read you, I told you some of the big names who support the Shabbos umbrella. Let me read you some of the names of those who oppose the Shabbos umbrella. And let me tell you why they oppose it, as appears in this article. And let's see, if enough people start using it, these arguments will fall by the wayside. Rav Yaakov Ariel. Probably the leading religious Zionist halachic figure, Rav of Ramat Gan. So he says that he doesn't permit it, even though it's not an issue of Malach on Shabbos. Why? Why doesn't he permit the heter? Because he's concerned that sheyavo atatel, that you'll come to carry umbrellas in Chutz Aretz, because in Chutz Aretz is no air of it. So he thinks. He hasn't been to America, where it's hard to find a city these days in America without an air of it. So that's a halachic argument, that in Israel you're not going to permit it because someone might come to America or Chutz Aretz and might carry. And Chutz Aretz is true that in Europe it's very rare to find Erevin. You have in London and you have Venice and Budapest now has an Erev, but not much more than that. But my question with these sort of arguments always is, so let's say, according to Rav Ariel, let's say I'm in Israel now and I carry the Shabbos umbrella. What have I violated? He acknowledges that it's not usher. He's only, but he's not going to permit it because of what it might lead to. So let's say I listen to the first part where he says it's not, there's no halachic argument, and I go ahead and carry it. What have I violated, according to him? I mentioned this example before because if you look at Tzitz Eliezer, five or six, one of those early volumes, he has a whole kuntras there about gelatin. And he quotes from Yecheskel Abramsky. His whole tshuva, he repeats of Yecheskel Abramsky. The whole argument of Yecheskel Abramsky, who was now based in London, is that gelatin is permitted. But then at the end, he says, even though halakhically it's permitted, we cannot permit it because this will lead people to think that halakha changes because we've been saying until now that it's usher. Now we're going to tell them it's mutter. He says it'll give ammunition to the conservatives. So
I forgot my microphone.
So then you have the argument. Okay, Rabbi Abramsky, let's say I eat gelatin. According to you, what have I violated? And I don't. It's not so simple. Who else is in this? Rav Dov Lior. Remember, Rav Dov Lior, formerly of Kiryat Arba, now of Jerusalem, who signed the letter, who wrote a letter that was published in the Kuntras about the Shabbos umbrella permitting it, he backtracks a little. And what does he say? He says that now he says not to do it. Why? Because yesh va shinoy ofya shel Shabbat Kodesh. It's changing the way we observe Shabbos. Then he says there's halachic issues. He says, although I gave the permission, now my opinion is different. Rav Aryeh Stern, Chief Rabbi of Jerusalem, He also gave permission. What does he say now? He says that although I gave permission, I tell you now, it's only for someone, not for someone who's healthy. And he says, we don't want to permit things that bring in changes for Shabbos. Rosham Aviner, he says, Uvda Dachol. I don't know. What's the Uvda Dachol here? We carry an umbrella during the week. First of all, this is a different umbrella. But we also wear a hat during the week. So why can't we wear a hat on Shabbos? I don't see the Uvda Dachol. Rav Micha Halevi, Chief Rabbi Petach Tikva, leading a religious Zionist figure. He also opposes it. Why? Because you won't distinguish between one umbrella and the other. You go into your closet, instead of taking the Shabbos umbrella, you'll take the other umbrella out. And he says also to change the way we've observed Shabbos, you need a all the Gedolim, and Rav Rimon. Finally, Rav Yosef Tzvi Rimon, a Rav in Gush Etzion, he forbids it. Why? Because it's been accepted in Kol Yisrael that Kavod HaShabbos means no umbrella, therefore Asur L'Shanotzot. We can't change this. Again, these arguments I find weird because then you couldn't use the Shabbos. We never turned lights on, and now we're doing it. Just these are, I don't think these are such strong arguments. These are arguments from tradition, so they're as good as they are until they stop being accepted. And as soon as people start using the Shabbos umbrella, I can tell you in America, if a Herschel Schechter would permit the Shabbos umbrella, or if the OU would put it on, then everyone would start using it. If the OU won't give a hashgacha, then people won't. But these are not really halachic arguments. They're hashgafic arguments. Let me get my stuff here. Lots of stuff today. Lots of piles I have. And thank you all who've been writing to me and enjoying these classes. I've been enjoying them. Frankel's really one of the very, very interesting figures. Here I have this book. Louis Ginsberg, Students, Scholars, and Saints. This is a collection of his essays. They reprinted it, and Jacob Neuser reprinted it. But in this volume, he has an essay on the Vilna Gaon. He's a direct descendant of the Vilna Gaon's brother, Ginsberg. He has some just general articles, and he also has articles on the personalities of Rishon Salanter, on Rav Zachariah Frankel, and Isaac Hirsch Weiss, on Solomon Schechter, and Rav W.C. Hoffman. So in his article on Frankel, and this will give you a sense of why I find Frankel so interesting, on page 125, he says that about Frankel, how Frankel was superior to Geiger and all the other scholars in Western Europe. Why? He united in himself old Jewish learning and modern critical schooling, so that it's difficult to say whether he was more of an old-time Lomdin or a modern scholar. That's the thing about Frankel. He has both. He's an old-time Lomdin and he's an academic scholar. Then he says, the other founders of Jewish science were either Talmudists who acquired modern education by themselves, he says Krochmo, Rappaport, and others, or modern scholars who were not Talmudists. But Frankel is both. He's an old-fashioned traditional Talmud Chacham and a modern academic scholar. We don't have many of those. Rabbi Chayak of Weinberg was one. Rabbi W.C. Hoffman was one. We don't really have very many, so that makes him pretty unique. Okay, I want to return to what we were in the middle of doing last time and finish it up today. If you recall, I said that the chief rabbi of Prague, Shlomo Yehuda Rappaport, Shir, famous figure, he wrote this essay, Divrei Shalom Ve'emet, defending Frankel. I have it here. And I just want to call your attention to a few more points. I said that his basic argument is that Hirsch and Fisher, they're reading something into Frankel. That Frankel never denies Halacha Moshe Sinai. He never denies the Torah Shebaal Peh. He's just a minimalist. And obviously, Frankel acknowledges that there is some Torah Shebaal Peh, some oral law. So, for instance, as I recall, he mentions... no, actually, I didn't share it. He mentions in Yirmiyahu, I think it's Perig Yud Tes, where actually one of my I'll show you hold on a second. I gotta get my bookmarks here so I can find I think it's Perek Yud Tes. Let's see if it's or Yud Zayin. Yes, I recalled correctly. Here, let me show you. If you look in Perek Yud Zayin, actually, of this is Yud Zayin of Yirmiyahu. So, for instance, he says in Pasuk Chaf Beis, neither shall you carry a burden out of your house on the Shabbos, nor do any work. What do you mean, carry a burden out of your house? That shows that there's already here. You neither shall you enter into the gates and sitting on the throne, riding in chariots, etc. That shows. Don't bring in, it says, no burden through the gates of the city on the Shabbos day. That apparently refers to doing business on Shabbos and leaving your house. Already speak to an oral tradition. And we said there definitely was an oral tradition. Now, there's so many areas where it's not clear where the Torah says something. So Frankel's a minimalist. But Halacha Moshe Mi-Sinai, there's a whole group of halachot. I'm going to give you another example here. Let me show you something here. Here, you can see this when it comes up. Hold on. So here I have all the examples from Bavli, all the references to Halacha Moshe Mi-Sinai. And so you see how many, there's a lot of them. And then there's Emes Amru, maybe that refers to Halacha Moshe Mi-Sinai. So we saw that Frankel really, he seems to regard all these as early traditions, but not going back, although we'll see what he says today, not going back to Sinai. Now, by the way, the whole issue of, here, I'll share another thing with you. Those who want to see how academic scholars look at this, you could see an article by Christine Hayes, Halacha Moshe Mi-Sinai, Rabbinic Sources, a methodological case study. She's just one of a number. I like mentioning her, though, because I'm so impressed. But her argument is that this study has uncovered a chronological shift in the Palestinian conception of Halacha Moshe Mi-Sinai. Early Palestinian sources tended to distinguish Halacha Moshe Mi-Sinai in scripture and then and regard it in a literal fashion. But later Palestinian sources and the Stam of the Rishami conflate Halacha Moshe Mi-Sinai and employ it in a metaphorical fashion. So, I mean, you can see a lot written by scholars. There does seem to be that later this is used much more than earlier, which will raise the question, how much is Halacha Moshe Mi-Sinai to be regarded as literal, how much not? But we saw that for the Rishonim, this is regarded as absolute. And one of you asked a good question. Robert, I said that Frankel said in a private letter, what's the difference if it's Halacha Moshe Mi-Sinai, if it's literal or not? We have to follow everything. And Robert says that, isn't there a difference if Halacha is biblical origin versus rabbinic? And I guess you're right, unless Frankel would say that in all these cases we're supposed to regard them as rabbinic, or probably he would say that Halacha Moshe Mi-Sinai is regarded as that everything he does is theoretical, and if the Gemara says Halacha Moshe Mi-Sinai, then since it's an ancient law, we regard it as having the same level as Doraisa. So especially since the Rishonim regarded it like this, and we have, by the way, you could make the argument there's a dispute over drushos. When Chazal darshan something, does that have the status of Doraisa or not? The Rambam says no, but the Rambam disagrees. So you can make the argument that even that Halacha Moshe Mi-Sinai should be treated like a drasha. But we'll get back to Franco in a few minutes, but I want to point out some of these interesting tangents that Rappaport mentions, because they're interesting in and of themselves. Like I said, if you took his defense of Franco, this will not be 34 pages. It'll be a couple pages, but he goes on and on and on at the various tangents. And I want to give you some examples. Some are relevant. Some are not relevant at all, but I think you'll find it interesting. And being that this is one of the major texts about the dispute over Frankel, it's worth noting it. So on page 8, we're only going to speak about Fisher and Hirsch's response, but there are other responses, as I mentioned. And thank you for those who pointed out to me in emails the other responses to Frankel. But in the response of Fisher, he makes a point how we need Torsh of Alpha, and the Torsh of Alpha is essential, and we can't assume that what we regard as Torsh of Alpha is from the Anshe Genesis of O or the Sofrim. And he gives the example, the famous example of Edim Zomim. What are Edim Zomim, the witnesses? Okay, so you have witnesses that say about someone, testify that this person did something that he'd be deserving of the death penalty. And then two other witnesses come I'm getting confused. Okay, the witnesses that claim that he's going to get the death penalty, and then they are challenged on it. If the witnesses who are disproven, they will get the death penalty. But if the false testimony goes through and the people actually are killed falsely, then we say that the Edim Zomim, the ones who caused their death, they don't actually get punished with the death penalty. Now, they get punished if they attempted to cause the death. They lied and they attempted to cause the death of the witness of these people. But if they actually succeeded in it, then even if we saw that they're false witnesses, they don't get the death penalty. Now, this is not this doesn't have human logic, Fisher says. This doesn't make any sense. If attempted murder, you execute someone. Certainly, if you cause the death, murder, kavachomer, you'd execute them. So Fisher's point is that this is an example of why, his argument is this makes no sense from our human intellect. We need the Torah of Alpeh, we need the Torah of Torah of Alpeh to tell us all these things. And Rappaport's response is that, wait a second, this goes against the Rambam's idea. The whole idea of the Rambam that all of our laws are supposed to make sense and are supposed to be intellectually respectable. So he goes off into this and he quotes the Ramban. The Ramban in his commentary on Parshas Shoftim, he says, let me pull it out here. And Fisher gives this, what he thinks is a good explanation for Edim Zomim, but I don't think anyone will be convinced. If you look in chapter 20 in the Ramban, verse 19, basically the Ramban's argument is that if the people die, we assume they had it coming to them because God would not allow the righteous judges who stand before him to spill innocent blood. That's the Ramban's approach, that it's basically bringing in the miraculous, that had Reuven been wicked, liable to death penalty, God would not have saved him from the hand of the court. But if Reuven's already killed, we are to consider that whatever the first witnesses testified against him was true, for he died due to his iniquity. So even if we assume the person's deserving of it. Okay, that's a little hard to accept in every case, but that's what the Ramban says. I have to tell you something that this might shock you, but it's true. In the 16th century in Italy, Siena, there was a man who converted to Judaism. He's known as Sixtus or Sixto of Siena. He became one of the most important Dominican theologians in 16th century Italy. And he attacked rabbinic Judaism, as many of these apostates did. They attacked the religion they came from. One of the things he focused on was the foolishness, the stupidity of Edim Zomim, that you intend someone to die and then you're killed. But then if you actually succeed, you live. So what sense does that make? So he claims. Well, if you kill the people who make the accusation that would lead to the death penalty, certainly if it actually leads to the death penalty in practice, the people who make the accusation should be killed. Well, there was a rabbi in Amsterdam named Rabbi Shaul Mortera. Here's a, we have a picture of him, actually. I don't know how accurate a picture it is, but there he is. He was the teacher of Spinoza, and actually signed the Cheirem on Spinoza. One of the people who signed the Cheirem on Spinoza, Rav Shaul HaLevi Mortera. He says as follows, that if the false witnesses, if the witnesses are shown to be false, and they were testifying on something like that the person would be get skill, let's say, stoning, and then they're found to be false witnesses, they get the punishment of skill. Whatever they intended for the other, they get. However, what Rav Mortera says that has no basis in anyone before him is he says, and he tries to read it into the Rambam, a diuk in the Rambam, this doesn't mean, so let's say the Edim Zomim testify that this person violated Shabbos and all that, that's a skila, and then we find out the Edim Zomim, and the person is killed, who they testified against it. So the simple understanding is that the Edim Zomim, they're not killed. I mean, that's not the simple, that's the basic halacha. But what Rav Shaul HaLevi Mortera says, all that means is that they're not killed by skila. However, they still are murderers, and we therefore kill them with the punishment that we give murderers, namely hereg, which is decapitation. So Rav Shaul Mortera says is that, yes, the Edim Zomim are not killed. They're not killed by the form of misa, of death, that they would have been killed had the person they're testifying at not been executed. But that doesn't mean they get off scot-free. It doesn't even mean they get off just something that will say based and, you know, put them in a kippah or something. No. The intention is that now they're murderers and we're going to kill and we execute them. Now, where he came up with this is he makes this claim in an apologetic response to Sixtus of Siena. So you could say, well, he didn't really believe it, but you know, he did believe it. But he was so convinced, I think you can say, by his need for this apologetic argument that he's led to really this point, which has no basis in any of the Rishonim, and his argument in the Rambam, and the Rambam doesn't say it, Rav Yaakov Sasportas. The famous Rav Yaakov Sasportas, maybe we'll go to Amsterdam in a future trip. Here he is. He attacks Mortera for this argument. There's Yaakov. A new book came out a couple of years ago, Dissident Rabbi, The Life of Jacob Sasportas, by a Princeton professor, Yaakov Dweck. I think it's right. Yeah, Yaakov, yeah. By the way, I was told by Rabbi Apfel, of Leeds, big student of Rabbi Yaakov Weinberg, that Rav Yecheskel Abramsky also said what Mortera said, that the Edim Zomim, that in other words, it's unimaginable that if I testify falsely and cause the death of someone, that I get off scot-free. Look, we know that Beis Din can do whatever Beis Din wants. Beis Din could... Do they have the authority to do anything? But we're saying that it's not just something that Beis Din on their own comes ahead and decides to do, so there's no anarchy. But that built into the system, all it means is that I don't get the punishment that I caused this person to be killed, but I'm still treated as a murderer. I haven't seen this anywhere in Vichesko Abramsky's writings, but Rabbi Apfel, he was a dying in Leeds, he certainly knew what he was talking about. Now, I don't know the context. It could be that Yecheskel Abramsky was interviewed by a newspaper, the Times of London, and it he put forth as maybe like an apologetic argument. I don't know, but Rav Shaul HaLevi Mortera, actually, that's what he says. But look, it actually is nice. It's nice. I hope it's true. But even if it's not true, even which I assume it's not built into the system. As we've said time and time again, Beis Din has the authority to really do whatever they want. And if they feel that this is going to lead to a Chil Hashem, or this could, these Edim Zomim are troublemakers, they can put them in a prison. They can execute them. They can lash them. They can chop off their nose. They can take out their tongue. They used to do this in Spain. The slanderers, they took out their tongues. Adulteresses, they chopped off their noses. I mean, gruesome. I don't think they want to do this today. But my point is that Beis Din can do whatever Beis Din whatever Beis Din wants. That's our assumption. One more thing. I think you'll find this interesting. On page 16, actually two more things. Page 16, he argues that obviously Franco believes in Halacha Moshe Mi-Sinai, but he's just pointing out error times when it's not literal. I mentioned that, so we don't need to go into it. But on page, this has nothing to do with most of his argument, has nothing to do with the major points. There are all these tangents, and there's a good tangent on page 20. And this, I think you'll find interesting, especially Rabbi Kelman, who's an expert in Avos. So let me show you what Shear says. Again, how Shear gets into this, it's totally irrelevant to anything to do with defense of Franco and Halacha Moshe Mi-Sinai and Torah Shebaal Peh. But he goes off like two pages on this. And I take that back. He gets into it because of a criticism. Someone criticized a theory that Frankel had, not related to Torah Shebaal Peh, just another theory. And that leads him into this tangent. He says as follows. Tell me what you think about this. About the beginning of Amos. You have Moshe Kibbutz Torah Mi-Sinai. Then you have the next one about Shimon HaTzadik. He says, on three things the world stands, on Torah, Avoda, and Gemilas HaTzadik. By the way, Rappaport says that Avoda doesn't mean, like we are accustomed, that means sacrifices. He says, no, Avoda means, Kol Maase B'Torah is called Avoda. And he gives all sorts of examples where the word Avoda is used to refer to just service of God. But then his focus is on the next one, three, Antigonus. Antigonus, nice Greek name there, who receives from Shimon HaTzadik. And what did Antigonus say? Don't be like the Avadim, the slaves. Hamashamshin esarav amanasa kabal pras. Don't be like servants, that's the translation we have here, who serve the master in the expectation of receiving a reward. An eved can mean servant sometimes. Rather, you should be like avadim hamashamshin esarav shalom amanasa kabal pras. Be like servants who serve the master without the expectation of receiving reward. V'imor shamayim aleichem, and let the fear of heaven be upon you. Okay, so first he just raises the immediate question. What does Mor HaShamayim have anything to do with the previous part? Why is that included here? And number two, he says, there's a problem in this Mishnah. What does Antigonus say? He says, don't be like Avadim, slaves or servants, who serve the master to get a reward, but be like servants who serve the master not to get a reward. It's the same thing. It's the exact same thing. Basically, you're not supposed to serve them to get a reward. That means you're serving them not to get a reward. So he says that's a problem. There's it doesn't make any sense. It's repeating the same thing. So he says, first of all, about the second point I made, he says the girsa should be as follows. There's another girsa. And he elaborates on this. It should say, and this is the correct girsa. Eved kavadim mshamshin sharav hold on a second. I think this actually has the girsa. Hold on. What does our Mishnahs usually have? No, this is shalom manas kabal pras. He says the real girsa is al manas shalom kabal pras. You should dafka do it not to get a reward. Okay, that's a side point though. But before I tell you what his argument is, just a couple interesting things here. You know, it says pros here. It's pros. The pros is a reward. Well, if you look in, and the Abarbanel, Rappaport Shear quotes the Abarbanel because the Abarbanel doesn't understand this. Don't we have many examples where Torah says that you're going to be rewarded? There's all sorts of rewards for observing Torah. So if not only that, the whole Sadducean movement. In Avos Rabbi Nassan, chapter 5, after the point of Antigonus, it says there's two students who studied his words, and they question this because how could a laborer work all day and not receive compensation? So they decided to separate, and they became the Sadducees and the Bitusians. So So Abar Benel has an argument. He says that what it means is that let me summarize for you. He says that what Antigonus is talking about is not a reward in this world. That's what you shouldn't be worried about. But you can get a reward in Olam Haba. And that answers is, but that's not, doesn't seem to be shot there. Then he also says, when you're doing the, another shot, when you're doing the labor, don't think about getting the reward. But if you get the reward later, then it's fine. However, the Rambam says something different. I think I'm correct in interpreting this Rambam. You tell me if I'm not. I don't know really if anyone mentions this, if anyone points this out, but here's what the Rambam says. And tell me if I'm correct in my insight on this in the Rambam in Perusha Mishnah. He says as follows. Let me find it here. Okay. He has to explain what's pras. It says that you can't, you shouldn't work al manas l'kabo pras. And by the way, I see the Rambam's girsa is here. Al manas shelo l'kabo pras. Not shalom, manas l'kabo pras. But he says as follows. A pras is a reward asher yigmo ha'adam misha eno chayev obedin. That you give someone who, according to law, is not obligated. That is something extra you give. You do it, why? Al derech chesed. You do it as a chesed. Like if you say to your little son, do something and I'll give you a reward. And the Rambam says, v'zehu ahekdo ben pras v'sachar. That's the difference between a reward and sachar, which is payment, I guess you could say. Ki asachar chayiv bo badin. Because a sachar, you're obligated, you get it, it's coming to you. And he says, what does Antigonus say? Don't serve so that you get a chesed. Well, what the implication of this is that what's Antigonus saying? He's saying, don't serve God on the expectation that you'll get a reward, a pras, a chesed, something extra. The implication is the Rambam says, though, this is not a schar, though. Sachar is something that you are deserving. In other words, at least the way I read it, you can serve Hashem and do all the mitzvos with the expectation that you have an IOU, that yes, you will receive sachar and olam haba. And that explains why we have all these examples, even in the Torah, where it promises sachar. There's nothing wrong, so I'm claiming, according to the Rambam, it might not be the highest level, but there's nothing wrong with serving God, at least according to this Mishnah, there's nothing wrong with serving God in the expectation of getting a sachar, because that is due to you. It's the pras, it's the extra, you know, the grace, as it were, that maybe Yom Kippur, Rosh Hashanah, even though you do deserve the punishment, but you want Kadosh Baruch Hu to go beyond the letter of the law and give you mercy. That's what you shouldn't be. Now, it's true that according to the Rambam, you should move beyond all of this, and you should do it just for the sake of doing it, the schar mitzvah mitzvah. That's the ultimate sachar of a mitzvah, is the ability to do a mitzvah. That in itself is of the value, but I think shot in this Mishnah, according to the Rambam, is that really fundamentally it's not referring to sachar, it's referring to only extras for us. Okay, so this is what Rappaport says. He's troubled also, but not because he didn't read it like I read it. He's troubled. How can you say not to, we shouldn't care about a future reward? And he reads it in a completely, I guess speculation, but a completely separate way. And he combines the three Mishnayos. He says that, what's the connection? He says here, it says, Hemidu Talmidim Harbe. You know, bring up many students. Then what does Shimon HaTzadik says? He says that the world stands on three things. One of them is on Torah. So he sees Antigonus here as following on what we've seen. And the issue here for Antigonus is teaching Torah. And he gives that's the main thing, teaching Torah. That's what you shouldn't do in receiving a reward. And he elaborates on this, and he puts it in the context that when Antigonus lived, they had people had very little money. and people would want to be paid for Torah. So he says that's what it's referring to, the reward of teaching Torah. And that then he ties into Moreh Shamayim Aleichem, that you should teach Torah for its own sake. In other words, the reward, it's not, you don't do it, you're supposed to teach Torah for free. That's his whole argument. Okay, it's a bit of a stretch, but that's what he argues. Now, on page 24, then he picks up with the criticism of Hirsch. And actually, no, we did 24. To go to page 28, I think it is. But he's going to pick up. What does Hirsch say? Where's the Hirsch? Here. Hirsch. Okay. Hirsch says as follows. Well, actually, not Hirsch. Fisher. On page 300 in the collected writings, he attacks Frankel, because Frankel did what we saw already in previous classes, that really, according to Tosafot Yom Tov, you can do, not in the Gra and the Rambam. He interpreted Mishnah sometimes different than the Gemara. Now, we've gone through this many times, so I don't want to belabor it again, but this is an idea that you find in unquestionably acceptable sources. They do it on an ad hoc way, and no one is changing the halacha, but the idea, the Vilna Gaon says, there's pshat and drash in Chumash, there's pshat and drash in Mishnah, let's say. And the pshat in the Mishnah doesn't have to be what the Gemara says. Now, Halivni does this page after page, and we saw Rav Dunner, we spoke of Rav Dunner, who does it as well. But others do it ad hoc. We saw the Tosfos Yom Tov in Nazir, chapter 5, Mishnah 5, I think it is, where he says, if you don't change the halacha, that's okay, you can do it. So Frankel did it also. And actually, though, this is not Fisher. This is Hirsch. Hirsch attacks him. What's the example he did it on? So I want to show you the example that Frankel, it's here.
Where is it?
It deals with this individual, this early, early figure. Do we even call him a Tana for the Maccabean period? He's a pre-Tana, I guess. He's actually a disciple. It says Antignos, Yosef ben Yoezer, who lived. We know that he was one of the Hasidim and very observed all sorts of different pieties. So here's the Mishnah that Frankel picks up on. Hey, Rabbi Yosef ben Yoezer, Yitzredo. Yosef ben Yoezer testified concerning Ayal Kamsa, the locust, that it's pure. Dachan. The Al Mashke Beit Mitbachaya, and concerning liquid of the slaughterhouse of the temple, that it's pure. De Inun, the Inundachyan, the Dikrav, the Misa, and one who touches a corpse, Mistaiv is impure. And because of that, they called him Yosef Sharia, Yosef the Permitter. So this is strange for a variety of reasons. What's a Mishnah doing, in Aramaic? How is the Mishnah in Aramaic when it should be in Hebrew? Second of all, what does this mean? If you touch a corpse, you're impure? And because that, he's Yosei the Permitter? What do you mean? That's the Torah tells us. We know that if you touch a corpse, you're impure. And why should you be the permitter? On the contrary, you should be the, first of all, why do you need to say this? And second of all, why are you the permitter? You should be the Asur, the one who's forbidding it. Well, the Gemara picks up on this in Avodah Zarah. And, okay, it goes through it. It gives an example. You can check it out. It's on Avodah Zarah, Lama Zion Amabez. It asks the question, where is it? It gives a few different answers. Yeah, it said the Gemara says they should have called him Yosef the Prohibiting. And furthermore, the halacha is written explicitly in the Torah. So then it gives an answer. The sages decreed that even one who touches another and who touches a corpse is also impure. So Yosef ben Yoezer came and established the halacha in accordance with the more lenient Torah law. By the way, this is going to be similar to what Frankel says. But then they go off and they give other explanations. What does Frankel say? Frankel develops a whole theory, which he tries to prove that what Yosef ben Yoezer is responding to, here, this is what I'll show you. Actually, it's the Gemara. here it says, what is the Gemara? The Gemara explains, by Torah law, one who touches a corpse is ritually impure. But one who touches another who has touched a corpse is pure. And the sages came and decreed that even one who touches another who has touched a corpse is also impure. And then Rabbi Yossi comes and establishes the halacha in accordance with the original more lenient law. So the way this is explained in the Gemara is, we have a question. What is Yossi ben Yoezer saying that if you touch a corpse, you're tummy? Of course you're tummy. That's we know that from the Torah. So the Gemara says the sages came and said that even if you touch someone who has touched a corpse, you're impure. From the highest level of impurity, they made it like a chumrah. And Yossi ben Yoezer came and says, no, let's go back to the original Torah law. That's why it's called Yossi the Permitter. But if you notice, it says here, and the sages came and decreed. Now, in this edition, this is the Koran Talmud. Whenever it's not bold, it's what they put in. If you look in the Gemara, the Gemara doesn't say this. It says Ve'asu inhu ugzar afilo dikarev. It just says and they came. So this Gemara, the Steinsaltz, Koran Steinsaltz is assuming it means the sages came. That is, the sages said, we're going to make an extra decree that not just the person who touches the dead body is impure, but if you touch, with all the problems that would create, but if you touch someone who touches the dead body, you're also impure. Frankel says it's not the sages. That's not what it's referring to. And Frankel explains, this is on in Darchei HaMishnah, in the second edition, or the 1923 edition, page 31. He says, I'm going to give you a pshat, and he says that we're allowed to do this. That I can give you an explanation of the pshat, which is not different from the Talmud. And he explains how this sect, the Hasidim, the pious ones, that goes back to the Maccabean period. It talks about all they were doing and that they were very, he says, this cut was very stringent when it came to laws of Tuma and Tara. And it's this cut. They're the ones, not the sages, but this sect of the sages of the sect, you could say. But we're not talking like regular sages, but this extreme sect. They're the ones who the nirash eza chasidim anshe dorosho yosi ratzu achmira adam hanogea b'meis la soso avi avos atuma k'mo meis atzmo. It were these. It was this sect of chasidim that Yossi ben Yoezer was part of them, that they wanted to make this extra stringency, and that's who Yossi ben Yoezer is responding to. Now later the Gemara goes off and has different explanations, but Frankel sticks with the first understanding, and he uses a historical explanation. And Hirsch doesn't like any of this. He thinks this is all speculation. He doesn't like the fact that you're going against what the Gemara says. Who knows more than about the Gemara than the know more about the Mishnah than the Gemara? And then on page 32, one of these people who responded for Frankel says as follows, responded to Hirsch. So you say that we have to follow whatever the Gemara says is the explanation of the Mishnah, but why do you assume the Gemara knows everything? Sometimes the Gemara doesn't get it right. And what does this person point out? That the Gemara makes a mistake because they translate this word, afutiki, as in Aramaic or Hebrew, potekan, when really it's a Greek term. The Gemara, it's in Bava Kamma, by the way, 11a, they explain this word, a Greek word, with an Aramaic. So this Landau says to Hirsch, we see the Gemara doesn't always have all the facts. The Gemara makes mistakes. If the Gemara could get it wrong on the etymology, then who says it can get the Mishnah right? So what I would say, if I was Hirsch, I would simply say, who says the Gemara gets it wrong? Yes, they could get it wrong, but we know that the Gemara uses a midrashic etymology, I would say. For example, Tiberius. If you look in the Gemara, why is it called Tiberius? And they give a midrashic explanation as to why it's called. But they knew Tiberius is the Roman emperor. And we have other examples of this. I'm not Apikoros. They derive it from Hefker. Look, in the Gemara, they might have been living in Babel. I'm not saying they knew Greek, but they heard of Epicurus. So they gave midrashic explanations. The Rambam says this, Mishnah, as I recall. So they gave midrashic explanations. But what I find interesting is Hirsch doesn't say that. He says as follows. Actually, sorry. Now at the end, I think he might have said it because he says that what's important is of these expressions is not their etymological origins, but the concepts which Chazal wanted to convey by using these expressions. So the origins of the word are not important. So okay, that's really what I was saying. So for example, if they say hefker, if they say Epicurus is related to hefker, it's because they want to stress the fact that the heretic treated Torah sages in a hefkeridic fashion, that sort of thing. But before he gets to that, look what Hirsch says. I could see Hirsch being put in Chayrim today for saying such a thing. After all, they put Slifkin in Chayrim. What does Hirsch say? I'm going to read it word for word for you. Hold on a second. Okay. This is what he says. He says to, having said that the Amoraim were the ones who best understood the Mishnah. Remember, Hirsch said that, Frankel, you have no authority to go interpret the Mishnah different than the Gemara because the Amoraim are the best authorities. And then this Landau says, well, sometimes they get it wrong with the etymology. So Hirsch says, having said that the Amoraim were the ones who understood the Mishnah best, must we also accept them as the best etymologists for the technical terms of ancient Greek? That is, Chazal or, Torah sages. Does that mean that the Amora living in Bavel knew every Greek word? If we were to concede that you, Dr. Lando, understands the etymology of these words better than they, must we agree that you also have a better understanding of the Mishnah? So, you see, he says, then he says, who could have written in a better Ciceronian Latin than Cicero? And yet, who could have been a worse etymologist, even for his mother tongue, than Cicero himself? His point is that, type, fine. You want to tell me that Chazal didn't know this Greek word because they're living in Bavel? Fine, but that's not what we're talking about here. We're talking about the interpretation of halacha as it appears in the Mishnah. What I find significant here is Hirsch's acknowledgement. And then later he goes on and he says that, but really the real reason is that the better explanation is that they're not speaking literal. We don't need to interpret these as saying they're giving the actual etymology. But before that, he puts out that this is not a concern of ours. If you want to tell me that they didn't know the etymology, fine. They didn't know the etymology of the word. Big deal. And we know that Hirsch writes that, when Chazal say that they discuss a case, an impossible, that today we know it's an impossible scientific case, Hirsch says Chazal were not interested. They didn't know the science. They were told by the doctors of their day, the leading doctors, that you could have, let's say, a case of like a rat or a mouse that grows out of mud. So since that's what the doctor said, that this is science, therefore the rabbis had to determine what the halacha is. I mean, Hirsch is one of the major figures that Slifkin cites as stating that there's incorrect science in the Gemara. Hirsch says that because Hirsch said the rabbis were not scientists. Whatever the leading scientists and doctors told them, that they accepted that. And they said, okay, then let's apply the halacha. But they never said this is Torah Shabbat Peh or anything. This is just okay. Just like today, if we're told that this is... the medical reality, we have to figure out the halacha. Hirsch says, what, the rabbis were supposed to investigate? They're supposed to travel all over the jungles and find out if you actually have animals like this? The same thing. Are Chazal supposed to know about all the etymologies of this Greek word, that Greek word? That's not of interest to Chazal. They're interested in concepts, not in etymology. Just like Chazal didn't know the etymology of Chinese words, they wouldn't have necessarily known those other words. But they're going to use the word for what they think is an important point, and they're going to give a Torah value to this word, and that's what's important to them. So, but the more fundamental issue in this one, Frankel has legs to stand on. His argument might not make a lot of sense from a historical standpoint, But the idea that you can interpret the Gemara, the Mishnah, different than the Gemara, he wasn't changing halacha. He just was giving a speculation, and that has a very good pedigree. Okay, now what we're going to get to next class is Frankel's reply. Frankel finally had to offer a reply, and I'm going to read to you his reply next class, and you'll see are you convinced or not. And then the point that I've been saying for a few classes, which he slips in, and which could have solved this whole controversy. Wait till you see what he adds in the second edition. He doesn't make a big announcement. It could have stopped pretty much the whole controversy, and we'll get to that. And then hopefully next class I'll even take it a little further. So where did Frankel's ideas then go? You know, what type of Nachleben, as they say in German, afterlife did they have? But let me mark this here, and I will pick up where we left off next class. In the meantime, I will take some comments and questions here. Always have good questions and good comments. They're doing my old classes. Now they're going to start with the newer ones. The head podcaster, Torah Motion, as a very talented young man who does the podcasts. And so he wants to put on some of the more current ones because people have been emailing, well, why only the older ones, not the current ones? So before we start with the Lieberman, I told him to put on the Nittel, Christmas Eve, because it's in Yonah Dioma. I gave that talk a couple of years ago, Torah study on Christmas Eve. I listened to some of the early ones he put on, and he cut out the back and forth. In those days, it was even more speaking back and forth. But that, after a few classes, he left it in because a lot of people said that that's what they enjoy. So the back and forth is actually an important point in our discussions here. So someone privately says that he sent the information about the Shabbos Umbrella to Rav Yitzhak Breitowitz. He's just a Breitowitz, a real chacham and a significant personality and influence in Israel. He was a rav for many years in America, and a posek. And he said that it's a brilliant idea that works. We have poskim. We have poskim of Breitowitz's level. We have poskim even greater than Breitowitz who've permitted it. We also have those who haven't. But in America, I want to see the American. I sent it to Rav Schechter, as I recall. I did. I sent it to Rav Schechter, and he never replied to me. And I've been going to YU sometimes now because my son's a student there. So I'll have to ask him because he did not give a reply. You have to get an American rabbis of stature, Rabbi Willig maybe. So and Eli says, would Rabbi Ariel say that we shouldn't carry a talus in Israel because it might cause people to carry a talus in Chutz Lartz? It's an excellent point. Or how about maybe you shouldn't carry a talus in America? Because if you go to Europe, you'll end up carrying bowings. It's not when I go on my trips, except for Gibraltar. Gibraltar has an Arif. But everywhere else we are, there is no Arif. So I need to tell people, well, and the people usually ask, but I have to tell them there's no Arif. But you're right. But it's not just in Europe. In places in America, there's no Arif too. In Ladav or Sof, then, you shouldn't carry anything. I don't know. I think what Rabbi Ariel's real point is that this is changing the Shabbos, what we've been doing. It's not so much the carrying, although that's what he mentions. I'll read it to you again. Because we always had Arifs. And we always carry taluses. We never had carried, which also really isn't true. There were places where they did it. But at least for the last 50, 60 years, 70 years, and many places much longer than that, we didn't carry umbrellas. And I think generally the Orthodox world unanimously has not carried umbrellas for a long time. Rav Ariel says, that's what he says. He doesn't even give the other reason. I don't know. I don't know Rav Ariel. I did receive a tshuva from him. It's in the Sefer I published, but I don't know him personally. And Deb says the arguments make no sense. I really do agree with you. They don't make sense because if we could imagine, let's say, go ahead 5 years. Let's say in America, Rav Schechter says they're permissible. And then we all start carrying it. We'll look back at this and we'll say, you're right. It makes no sense. But at the moment, we're it had, in other words, we haven't yet created momentum one way or the other. This was just invented recently. The rabbis are still discussing it, and there's going to be momentum is going to move in one direction, as we saw with the scooter on Shabbos. We saw already that at least in the South, in the free state of Florida, where Yaakov is right now, I don't know if he's going to see it where he is, but just go to Boca or Hollywood, you'll see it. The momentum already moved in a direction, and the rabbis didn't protest. I mean, we'll have to see if the momentum moves and everyone starts carrying a Shabbos umbrella, Rav Nebensol, I mean, he's a great, great posek. If everyone just starts doing it, then these other voices will be left behind. And then they'll start accepting it, because once everyone does it, Rabbi Kelman, everyone can click on this. He wrote about the strange aspect of Adim Zomamin using the explanation of David C. Hoffman. I don't know the explanation of Rav Hoffman, so I'll have to take a look at that. I guess in his commentary on Devarim, probably, is this is one of the great mysteries. And although Scheer is very annoyed with Fisher saying that, you know, we can have something that doesn't make any sense, and it's only just because it's Torah we can accept it. Without Torah, we think it's crazy. I'm actually sympathetic to that argument, that of Fisher, because we do have things that we can't really explain. Granted, the Rambam tries to explain them all. He doesn't explain Adim Zomamin, but the Ramban does. But there are certain things that we really can't give an explanation, and we just have to accept that this is the way it is, and we never would come up with these things on our own. Eli says that Adim Zomamin do not have for country in the first service. No, they're not country. They say that he was with us, so he couldn't have been... They say that he could not have done it. That's why contradict. The Adim Zomamin say that these people could not have done it because they couldn't have witnessed it because they were with us. But as the result of contradicting their testimony, by definition, their testimony is invalid because they couldn't have been there. So that's a contradiction. Mel says that the whole world of Adim Zomamin is a chiddush. You can't expect to apply logic to it. But that's exactly what Fisher says. And that's why Fisher says that we can't assume that the sages would be able to come up with things, Torah Shabbat Peh, because so much of Torah Shabbat Peh is tied into aspects like Adim Zomamin, where on our own we never would figure it out. But Scheer cites the Ramban and says, no, the Ramban gives a good explanation. And he thought that this is disrespectful to the Torah to say that it doesn't make sense. Basically, Fisher says it doesn't make sense. From human intellect, it doesn't make sense. And Scheer says that goes against the Ramban's principle that all the Torah makes sense. We just have to investigate it and figure it out. But I think Fisher makes more sense than Scheer, in my own opinion.
Wouldn't you say that Imanu Hayitem is not a contradiction of facts? It's saying you couldn't have said it, but it's not actually saying it's not actually a contradiction. It's a step less than a contradiction of the fact.
Well, what would a contradiction be? That's like more than a contradiction.
It's not true. He didn't.
That's making it impossible.
He didn't commit the murder.
How can you ever testify?
I saw that he didn't commit the murder. That's a contradiction. But I'm not saying I saw.
Okay, you're right. And now I'm thinking of another example. If the Adim Zomamin testify that this guy killed John Doe, but I know they didn't kill this guy didn't kill John Doe because I know someone else who killed John Doe.
Yeah.
So that would not be. You're right. So Adim Zomamin, but Mel says they certainly don't get off without any punishment. But what's the punishment, then, Mel? I think the general assumption is it has to be an ad hoc based in sort of punishment. But where Shaul Mortera says that built into the system, in a Torah, they don't get off with a punishment. That's a chiddush. I think everyone assumes, of course, they get off with the punishment midiraisa. It's only derabanan if the based in wants a punishment that has the authority. But Mortera, and according to Rabbi Apfel, Rechesko Abramsky said that they do get a punishment midiraisa. The punishment is that they're considered rotzlim. And they get the punishment for a murderer, Herod. Now, that is not found anywhere in the Gemara. It's not found anywhere in the Rambam, even though Mortera tries to make a diuk in the Rambam.
Get Malkos. There are other cases where you cannot do Kasha Zomam. They get Malkos.
Okay, that's a murder. then that's not death. We're saying here, saying a punishment. Okay. But I'm saying that Mortera says if the people were killed, he gets Misa, and that's Minatora, as a murderer, as a Rapseach. And that's not found anywhere. But that's what he says. If you want to psychoanalyze this, you could say he faced with the faced with being in a position of being apologist against an apostate who's mocking Torah Judaism, he convinces himself this must be the halacha. But it's not there. And that's why Rebecca Sasportas criticizes. Chaim Malch says,
you're saying that actually the punishment of the Edim Zomimim is they socially they will put them aside like a heaven?
No.
What?
No, murder. They will be killed.
By
they
whom?
Will be killed if they cause the death of someone, and as they will be regarded as rotzlim. So they will not be given the punishment that they planned on giving to the other person, that is skila they'll be given what a rotzeach gets. They won't be getting the burning, which isn't burning at a stake, but put something down his mouth. That's the finish of Mortera. That an Edim Zomim, if they cause the death of someone, it's not that they're putter and then Beistin can decide to give them a punishment. The Torah gives them a punishment, but the punishment is as a rotzeach, not as Edim Zomim. But that's a big finish. And this was a big debate between Rashal Haif Mortera and Yaakov Sasportas. Yaakov Sasportas is known as the great persecutor of the Sabbateans, those who are interested in that. But that's what he says. Now, Chaim says that isn't there an inherent irrational aspect to Edim Zomim? Why are the second witnesses more credible than the first? Isn't it possible that the defendant eyewitnesses? Yeah, I mean, it's a Ein L'Dav Rasolf, and then you can have a third set of witnesses. I don't know where. It seems to be that the most recent ones are the most believable. We're in election season. So going back to the Bush-Gore election of 2000, I was very interested in this, especially because my in-laws were living in, or my wife's grandmother was living in Broward County. If you remember Broward County, it all came down to the vote there. So there was a lot of talk they're going to do, so they did a recount. Or they said they're going to do a recount. I think they did a recount. I read a whole book on this about the election. So I wrote to the author of so they have the first election. This is, by the way, all elections. You give the number. Let's say you win by 1,000 votes. Then they do the recount. And in the recount, you win by 1,200 or 700, whatever it is. That's the figure. So I wrote to this author, I think he's a reporter. I don't know which newspaper wrote the standard book on the Bush-Gore election. My question was, why do we assume that the second count is reliable? Why is the second count any better than the first? If you do the third recount, you get a different number also. You're never going to get the exact same number. So if there's a recount and I lose, can I say, well, the first, he said, that's the system. We always assume that we go by the second recount. So I don't know. Let's say a third set of witnesses come and they make the second set of witnesses Edim Zomim. I don't know. It's a good question. User says, if Edim Zomim are killed, even if the party was killed as a result of their witness, then no one will come forward as a witness because there will not be a cutoff time when they will be safe from those who want to harm them. 10 years after bearing witness, people can come forward and claim they were Edim Zomim. Okay, that's a good way of understanding it. That's a nice
Rabbi C. Hoffman's explanation right there.
That's Rabbi C. Hoffman.
Nice. I mean, he has more. There's more, but that's that part. Yeah, that's the piece Rabbi C. Hoffman says about that piece. Correct. Yes.
Okay. So it's a statute of limit. We want to make a statute of limitations. We want to be concerned. We don't want to be concerned that the years forward, someone will come back. You're right. It's a good, it's a good explanation, actually. Yeah.
Someone is a special case. It's not that they're more recent. If you have witnesses who come and contradict the first ones, you don't believe them because they contradict them. They're hakosha and you cancel them both. Zomim is a special case when they come and say you were with us. That's a very special case, and it's not following necessarily logic.
Well, it's not following logic, but the question was why do we believe The first two witnesses say that we were in New York and we saw him commit this crime. The second set of witnesses says, no, no, you were in New Jersey and you couldn't have seen it. So the question is, why are the first set of witnesses worse? You know, why are they trumped by the second set of witnesses?
There's a custom.
Rav David Zvi Hoffman gives, if you read the article, he gives a logical explanation why they're more, why it's more likely the second ones are true. That's his chiddush. That's the part we didn't explain here. That I don't want to, but Rav David Zvi Hoffman explains there's good reason. It's a slightly complicated, but it makes a lot of sense when you read it, when you understand it, that why, from a purely logical, statistical point of view, there's good reasons why we believe the second set of witnesses. Well,
but so let's say the agents, the second set of witnesses, let's say there's 10 witnesses to the murder. And then the two witnesses come and say, all 10 of you were with us.
It has to do with the fact that the Adim Zomamin, why would somebody lie?
No.
You go to the psychology of lying. Why are you lying? Are they lying because they hate the witnesses, or are they lying to get the murder, the guy off? They say Reuven killed Shimon. And they say, no, no, you couldn't have seen Reuven kill Shimon. You were with us. So why are they doing that? Are they doing that because they want to save Reuven's life? Reuven's their good friend. Or they say hate the guts of the witnesses. They want to kill the witnesses. So that's what it's based on, but we'll leave it there.
There is Gzeiros HaKosov. And Gzeiros HaKosov tells us that, and you look at Rashi on the spot, as I recall, that tells us that only if the person's killed, then you're not. So,
correct. It's only killed, that explains that's the statute of limitations.
Yeah. That's a good explanation.
But for the first half, why you believe the second part, he gives a whole explanation there. But okay.
But if the second
I didn't remember that explanation. That's very good. Danny, you're right. If I said Slifkin put in Chayrim, I meant the Slifkin Enterprise, not him personally. Although that's also of interest. Why not put him in Chayrim? You have the whole idea during the Slifkin controversy where they said the books are heresy, but he's not a heretic. What does that even mean? Isn't the definition of a heretic one who preaches heresy? So here you have a case where they said the man preaching heresy is not a heretic, but his books are heresy. But how could you preach heresy and not be a heretic? So it creates a bit of a conundrum there. Someone I know asked Rav Moshe Sternbach this question, and Rav Moshe Sternbach said, we hold like the Rivot in this case, that Slifkin doesn't know any better. So therefore, his ideas are kfira, but he's a kofer b'shogeg. So therefore, we don't regard him as a heretic. But for the people who don't accept the rival to go with the Rambam, I thought that was very interesting that Rav Moshe Sternbach said that. I don't know if that's the logic of the others.
Rafaim, of course, says an apikoros nevech, an apikoros b'shogeg.
Yes, and that's the Rambam's position. Yeah. So, but the Raivad, it's good that we go by the Raivad, but it's not. I asked my friend, colleague, who davens Rav Moshe Sternbach, is this Rav Moshe Sternbach's logic? And he asked him, and that's exactly what Rav Moshe Sternbach said, because I couldn't imagine any other way of teaching this, to use the yeshiva terminology. Someone writes heresy, but he's not a heretic. That's the definition of a heretic, when he writes heresy. And Rav Moshe Sternbach, I was mechavim, says the exact same, exactly what he says. Now, I don't know about all the others. I mean, there's a whole long list of people who signed a cherem saying it's heresy. You'd have to ask the rest of them whether that's their understanding. And for all I know, maybe some of them would say he's a heretic. I have no idea. It's a crazy world they had there when they were attacking him like that. Zev says, Yaakov says, if God provides him with food and clothing and protects him, he will choose to follow God. Clearly expecting a reward was acceptable to God. Well, I mean, we have lots of examples that if you keep what Ava aim, the Torah itself gives examples. Aman yirichon yamecha. So that's what the Abarabin is saying. How can Antignos Ishtochel say differently than that? So you come up with all these different explanations.
Homer Sela Zul, it's the Sela Zul, it's stuck of his Yoshi Yichah, Beni, Harezet, Tzadik Amor. The Gemara Rosh Hashanah, a guy gives like staka in order that his kid should live. He's a Tzadik Amor. I do write about it in my stuff on Berkeyah.
The most obvious example is the second paragraph of the Shema.
Okay, yeah, and we have many examples showing God promises. God has promises. So you can, the tradition always is, you don't need to be Levi Yitzchak or Bedichev. The tradition is that you can go to the Kadosh Baruch Hu and say, this is what, this is what, you promised. So there's different ways of understanding it, the Mishnah. Like I said, my reading, which I don't know is correct. I've never seen anyone else. I actually take that back. I think the Sansino, translation alludes to this, but you have to distinguish in pros and, sahar, that you can expect the sahar. It's the pros you can expect. I believe the Sansino on the Mishnayos there just, it quotes the Rambam as saying the difference between sahar and pros. So presumably they also, by quoting that, they would read it the way I did. Even aside from that, you have to distinguish in different levels. At a basic level, you can do a mitzvah and expect to get the reward. But that's not the highest level. It's better to do it not wanting the reward. That's at least how the Rambam would understand it. Deb says, what if you open the umbrella before Shabbos and don't close until after? If you're saying a regular umbrella, that's the Chasam Sofer's position, and that's what people, certain people, list followed. We assume otherwise that today, and the Chasam Sofer, he says that it's best not to do that either. But I can't say it's us, sir. And he says the Hamonam does it. We today assume that even if you open the umbrella before Shabbos, you can't use it. The Shabbos umbrella, that's not an issue at all. And Marty says, would all those who oppose the umbrella because of change also oppose a Shabbos elevator? Yeah, Shabbos elevator, machine matzah. I don't know where you would draw the line. Someone privately says the pastrunacy and ritual purity sounds a scene. Yossi Ben Yoezer was about that period, but he actually is reacting to that influence. Well, he was one of these pietists of Yossi Ben Yoezer. So he's either reacting, and we know the pietists were very interested in Tumah Tara. So he could be reacting to extreme pietists who went further than he wanted to, or any sort of influence in those days. I don't know. I'm not a Second Temple person. I don't know what we say about the Essenes versus the Hasidim, and I think today even the scholars are not so sure that the Dead Sea sect is a scene. But yes, purity was a big deal there, and Yossi Ben Yoezer is reacting to, he says, Frankel says, Yossi Ben Yoezer is reacting to extreme purity. We already saw the famous thing from Rav Soloveitchik and Saul Lieberman. We spoke about in the Lieberman classes about a Sheretz. Where, being Metame on a Sheretz, which was a Dead Sea. We found this in the Dead Sea Scrolls. And the Rav asked Lieberman, do you take it seriously? Lieberman said, yes, it's a different tradition. And the Rav says, it's not a different tradition. It's not. It's Amaratzim. Just like we have Amaratzim today, we had Amaratzim then. But I think Lieberman's correct. Two more minutes. Regarding Chazal not being scientists, Schaffer tells us, I once had a discussion with a prominent modern Orthodox Shabbat regarding this issue, and he noted the Gemara concludes it's permissible to kill lice on Shabbos because they generate spontaneously. And I responded by saying that they were correct in their conclusion of the Halacha, but wrong only in the Metzius. If you can find such a creature, you would indeed be able to kill it on Shabbos. Okay, that's I what you say is important, and I accept that. Halacha Maisa, what do you do about lice on Shabbos? That's already a dispute that goes back to the Pachad Yitzchak, the Halacha Encyclopedia in the 17th century. He discusses this matter. One of the great rabbi doctors, by the way, take a look at the Steinbog. Anyone who's interested in doctors, Eddie Reichman has an amazing post about all the Jewish students who went to the university, the medical school in Padua, including the Ramchal attended there. I mention that because I can't remember if Lanfranti was in Padua, but he was a doctor, and his argument was he was in Padua. Okay, so
that's in the article. Yeah, it's a phenomenal article, and I'll put in a plug for our medical ethics conference that we're, please God, going to be doing live. We haven't even announced it yet this year, but Eddie, of course, comes all the time, and he's amazing, and some of that stuff he's spoken before, the history, the medicine in Padua, which is really, really fascinating stuff. Okay, sorry about
He's
that.
Discovered unbelievable things, and they did. They did a whole exhibition there. I've been to Padua, but I haven't been since they created this new museum there. And I didn't know that the Ramchal, that we had the evidence that he was actually a student there, but many, many Talmidim were there. So the Pachad Yitzhak says you have to change the halacha. And there's others who say this. I mean, talk about poskim in our day. And today we can't kill lice. And then there's the opposing position, his teacher, Yehuda Briel. And today, many poskim, Rav Herzog was one of them, who thought that we don't change halacha because of what we know, modern medical science. So it's one of these disputes that it's hard to know. So Rabbi Kelman, I think we've reached the end today. Thank you all.
Tomorrow morning. Tomorrow, 1 p.m., Rabbi Shulman, just want to let you know, we'll be posting soon once we get it all up, our Hanukkah program. But just to give you a heads up, some of the speakers we're having for Hanukkah are Benny Gesundheit, Ari Shvat, Malka Simkowitz, Lindsay Guhartz, Tani Feintuch. That's will be over the next week or so, starting next week for Hanukkah. Just look up for the email as sort of a special shiurim for Hanukkah. And then, of course, we'll start with the winter program. Dr. Shapir, of course, will be away for a couple weeks in Morocco. Like I said at the beginning, those who want to come are more than welcome. And there's still a little bit of room and our summer trips, but we hope to see you soon. Like always, please invite a friend. And David and Nolene, I see you on now. If you weren't here before, I want to thank you for your sponsorship. And remember, Nolene's father. We should have good memories and long life, and we should have good occasions to celebrate. So thank you again, and Laila Tov to everybody, and we hope to see you soon. Thank you very much. Okay.
Laila Tov.
Laila Tov.
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 Tov.